from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Sexy Beast, that's how Martin Amis refers to the title character of his latest novel, Lionel Asbo, State of England. His creation, Lionel, is a gangster with a love for extortion, topless models, and feeding his dogs Tabasco sauce. But he's also got a soft spot for his bookish young nephew. Martin Amis joins us to discuss his latest novel and his love for misbehaving characters. He's the author of numerous other works, including The Rachel Papers, Money, and London Fields. He'll be with us in studio for the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. Martin Amis has published 12 previous novels. His most recent one is Lionel Asbo's State of England, and he's also the author of the memoir Experience and two collections of short stories and six of nonfiction. Former literary editor of The New Statesman and professor of creative writing at the University of Manchester in the UK, he's presently residing in Brooklyn. The title character in his newest novel is self-named with the acronym Asbo, which stands in the UK for Antisocial Behavior Order. And Lionel lives up to his name with criminality, thuggery, and violence. But he's also has a half-black nephew, Dez, whom he cares about and for in a rather unique and sociopathic way. Martin Amis takes us into a rich Dickensian world of disorder, class conflict, tabloidization, darkness, and irony. And if I dare use a word that a committed atheist and close friend of Christopher Hitchens, to whom this new book is dedicated, might not except blessedly love. He joins us in studio for this forum hour. Delighted to have you back on forum.
Thank you.
Well, enjoyed the novel. As I said, there's a lot in here, a lot of vitality, a lot of humor, a lot of darkness as well. And I thought we might start talking about it in terms of nature and nurture, because here's Lionel, who was a thug even as an infant, has a national record, in fact, for smashing windows at an early age. And here's Dez, his nephew, who has a kind of sweet innocence about him, a thirst for knowledge, a hunger for knowledge that his uncle eschews and so forth. And I thought, you know, you're kind of playing with nature nurture there, aren't you?
Well, I mean, some things, some aspects of writing novels are very crude and almost, you know, childishly simple. And what happens when you're creating a really demonic character like Lionel, the novel will demand that you have an angelic character as well, for symmetry's sake. And, I can do Lionels. I've done them before, but it was more of a challenge for me to create a good character and make him live on the page. It's nature-nurture in that Desmond believes in nurture and wants to improve himself, just as Lionel is on the opposite path. I think, and I think you might agree, that people we think of as thugs and from, what can you call it, the underclass, used to be called the residuum, are in fact often very bright, very articulate and vivid and expressive. But if their intelligence is not encouraged, then they make a sort of personal cult of being stupid. And as Desmond says of Lionel, he gives being stupid lots of very intelligent thought.
Well, he comes across as being quite stupid, but there's a kind of canniness and wiliness, I guess, that one has to concede is part of that intelligence you're talking about, yes?
Yeah. His values are all upside down. But
sorry, but I'm thinking about his advice to his nephew. You know, get out there and start stealing and smoking and watching porn. I mean,
that's right. And do you carry a knife? No, he says. We'll take one from the kitchen drawer on your way out. No, he's a sort of counter-father, an anti-dad. But Desmond, who has his own kind of wit, listens to what Lionel says and then does the opposite.
Well, in fact, I'm not going to give the plot away here, but he certainly does the opposite of something that is quite verboten in Lionel's sense of values could, in fact, present something lethal for him were Lionel to find out about it. It's really the propelling element of the plot that gives it a lot of its life. And yet even that has, he's a tender character, and he's meant to be portrayed as a tender character, isn't he?
Who, Dez or Les?
Yeah, Dez.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you feel tender about Lionel, I know, but I'm talking about Dez as a character.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was a great challenge because, as Henri de Montalant famously said, happiness and goodness writes white. The letters don't show up on the page. It's in all literature, there are very few writers who've made happiness sort of jive on the page, and Tolstoy is one. But Dickens, who loomed over this novel like a god, shows the usual pattern, which is all the energy goes into the frumps and eccentrics and wags and villains, and his good characters are completely faceless, indeed bodiless, and they don't live on the page.
The demonic is more fascinating to us in many ways, isn't it?
It is. As Updike said, the things we like in fiction do not correspond to the things we like in our daily existence. And he says, in fact, you know, why do we like Becky Sharp? Why do we like the villains? And he says, Updike said, what we like is life. And the transgressors seem to be more alive than the congenial characters.
Well, Lionel certainly fits the transgressive mode and is a fascinating character. We should mention to listeners that he becomes famous. He wins the lottery. He's a guy who lives in a place called Diston. It's an impoverished neighborhood. It's a place where fistfights have moved into knife fights and where, for the most part, I really like the way you kind of bifurcate that world as being light and the world of wealth that he suddenly steps into and finds himself as being heavy.
Yeah, well, I had to sort of feel my way into Lionel. You know, he goes from being a very violent but not very successful criminal, a subsistence criminal, to 140 million pounds sterling. And he's suddenly staying in huge hotels in the Strand. And there's a line in Larkin, O loose moth world, looking down from a lighthouse in snow. And that's distant. Everything is contingent. Disaster goes from house to house like a postman. And there he is in the Pantheon Grand. And this is a hotel really rooted to the earth. And everything feels heavy in it because it's not contingent. It's been around for a long time. You know, it's established in a way that nothing else in his life is.
And suddenly he's the lotto lout. I mean, he's the subject of much fodder for the tabloids.
There's a whole community, well, not a community, but a whole stratum in England called lotto louts, partly because only, quote-unquote louts do the lottery. And they occasionally win, and then the tabloids follow them around, hoping they're going to disgrace themselves, and so it goes on. And he's a sort of champion lotto lout. I read the autobiography of one quite famous lotto lout called Mikey Carroll, and I thought it would be full of good material for me, hints for me, but his was the normal trajectory of a lottery win, then cocaine, then girls, and still being a criminal in a minor way and going to court in rather nicer cars than he used to. And that was the only difference. And it ends with him poised to lose everything, which he did do. But I realized that I couldn't use any of that. I couldn't have that trajectory. Simply because it was cliché.
I can't use words like this on air, but were there gilfs and nilfs and those sorts of things that you have in your novel?
Yeah, there were certainly dilfs.
Yeah. speaking of words we can't use, there's the C word that Lionel uses prolifically, which has to do with female genitalia. And
no, I don't think he does use that word.
Yeah, I find him using the word quite frequently, actually.
But
as a put down for being possessed and being declassed, really, in many ways, yes?
It's a word that in England is never used of women. It's always of men, and it implies stupidity.
Yeah, but he uses it about himself.
Yeah, he does. Yeah,
exactly, yes, my point. Yeah, and there's, again, that sense of that class division that's almost embodied in that that word that has very different
applications.
Application, thank you, in the U.K. Speaking of application, you know, I read your book, and I thought, this is in some ways, and I'm hesitant to use this word, but kind of a moral book. I thought about writers like John Gardner. I mean, that's not usually your province, but in many ways there's an allegorical quality to it. I mean, you've got characters named Threnody and the Dawn and Grace, and it gives that feel.
The genre is Dickensian. I only really discovered that towards the end, not just the furniture, the London furniture, but the genre. It's semi-magical. There are twists. There are mysteries. It's a sort of fairy tale, nursery rhyme kind of world. But I think all my books are moral. I don't think a book works unless it works morally. And it's strange that that should be. But when I came to revise it, it was what was wrong with it was that it was morally not right. And that's what I had to fix. And it was a hell of a job. And I've never had that trouble before. So you're right in that it could be accused of sentimentality, and that's something I've perhaps been too frightened of in the past.
I wonder why that fear of sentimentality. In fact, I remember interviewing many years ago David Foster Wallace, and he said, why are we afraid of sentimentality? It's something that can enrich our lives.
Well, as Nabokov said of Dickens, the death of Little Joe in Bleak House, he said, I would not like this passage to be accused of sentimentality. People who do that don't know what sentiment is. But I think, you know, the dictionary definition is coarse and unworthy emotion, and we know that when we see it. So it's much more of a challenge to create a good character than a bad.
We're talking, if you just joined us, with Martin Amis, who is the author of Lionel Aspel, a novel, and who will be speaking tomorrow night at the Jewish Community Center in San Francisco at 7 p.m. And Thursday, actually, will be in conversation with me at Book Passage in Corte Madera at 7 p.m. I noticed a Book Passage said, Martin Amis is now an American writer living in Brooklyn. It's like Auden can be an American, you can be an American. I mean, as soon as you move here, suddenly, you've got that identity.
Well, I am sort of semi-American in that four of my five children are half American. My first wife and my wife are Americans, and I lived here as a child. And that turns out to be the important link, because it's the language link. If I'd spent a year, age 9 to 10, in Paris, I would speak French. And I can't, but I can speak American. I can write American.
Can also speak working-class British, one discovers in this novel, which was not necessarily the argot you were raised in.
I am bilingual, you might say. Well, I was sort of raised in that milieu, in that when my father's first novel was published.
We should mention for listeners, Kingsley Amis, one of the great comic writers, Lucky Jim.
Lucky Jim. Their life, my parents' life, took off a bit, and I and my brother and sister were parked with our cleaning lady for months on end, and she had two children and an unemployed husband, and I certainly got the feeling of, for want of a better word, the working class life, and I've continued to this day to have contacts in that world.
Fascinates you, doesn't it?
It does. Titillates me. And as I said, and vivid it is down there. So I wouldn't say I'm, you know. I once asked my father, I said, what class are we? I said, are we nouveau riche? And he said, well, very nouveau and not at all riche, he said. But then later he said, we're sort of bohemian. We're middle bohemian. And that is... includes the intelligentsia and so on.
I saw a gold vase once in West Hamptons, and it said Nouveau is better than no Riche at all. Sort of epitomized something, and still does in my mind. But you talk about Brooklyn now as being like Arcadia and pre-lapsarian, and I mean, you really love it there, don't you?
It's it's almost embarrassing living in Brooklyn. It's so mild. It's like living in the 1950s. Very child-orientated, lots of pregnant women and prams and kiddies and young families, and a sort of gentle atmosphere. Where I lived in London, near the zoo, was quite like that too, but you only had to walk, you know, for 3 minutes in the other direction, and you were in a seething metropolis, not at all Arcadian. But and Brooklyn no doubt has its rough bits, but all I've seen...
Not like Distin.
Not like Distin, no.
We're going to continue talking about the novel, but I want to bring up Christopher Hitchens, to whom, as I said earlier, the novel is dedicated, and I mean, someone who I was quite fond of and who had been on this program many times, and it was a very rare and unusual friendship you two had. He writes about it in Hitch 22, and you've gave the eulogy at his rights. There's a sense that there was really something unparalleled almost in the closeness that the two of you had, where you could be, I think you spoke about it as being completely emotionally naked with someone that in ways that you couldn't be with anyone else, and spoke of, as he did, of the love that was binding the two of you.
Yes, it was an unconsummated gay marriage, basically. closer than a brother, because I love both my brothers, but I didn't choose them. And with Christopher, what seemed to mark out, to distinguish the friendship from all others, was that I never had to tailor myself. I never had to censor myself when I talked to him. My father, in his correspondence with Philip Larkin, says that nothing is too shameful and base that I can't reveal it to you.
And Philip Larkin was your godfather, in fact, wasn't he?
No, my brother's godfather.
Oh, your brother's godfather.
And
sorry.
Namesake.
Yeah.
That's how I felt with Christopher, that whereas with other friends, beloved friends, you'd say, well, I better not say that to so-and-so because he, you know, wouldn't like that. Certain predispositions in your other friends that exclude certain remarks. But with Christopher, it was absolute, you know, open season reciprocally. And I despair of ever having that again. What surprised me about his death is that it has not yet caused a depression in me, although I'm clenched waiting for it. What it has caused, it was a disaster when he died, but I found that since then it's as if he has bequeathed his love of life to me. And I always envied his love of life. It always seemed superior to mine. His, you know, love of life so intense that he never went to bed, basically. He never went to sleep, at least. And I like to think that he, in fact, died at the age of 72, not 62, because his day was 4 or 5 hours longer than ours. But, you know, just walking down the street, I feel a sacred duty to respond lovingly to what I see, because he can no longer do that.
You also admire his courage, as did I. As do I.
His courage. Yeah. I mean, his courage was one of his great attributes. And often in the old days, in the 70s, we'd be in some, you know, pub that was like the intergalactic bar in Star Wars, you know, with all different...
strange-looking characters.
There's a lot of strange-looking characters. And we'd sometimes get into a bit of a wrangle with... a rank of these aliens, and I would be saying, "Come on, Christopher, God, let's slip away," And he just wouldn't bend an inch to anything like that. And he, when he got beaten up in Beirut for scrawling obscenities over a religious fascist poster, again, you know, no sense of, almost to a reckless extent.
Reminds me of Lionel in that way you describe him. I mean, not only in that recklessness, but also Lionel's described as being almost suicidal in the quantities of drink that he would imbibe.
Yes, perhaps Christopher was the secret inspiration for Lionel.
Well, there's also the secret inspiration, I thought perhaps, maybe even unconsciously, when there was that big flap in the British newspapers about you getting an advance and your dental work and all that. I don't want to go into that, but I'm sure you don't either. But here's Lionel suddenly getting all this attention in the press because he got a lot of money, you got a big advance. And I thought, well, maybe there was some connection there.
Maybe, but what was unpalatable about me getting a big advance was that it was for writing a literary novel, and that's resented. Getting a huge amount of money for nothing, for just filling out a lotto coupon, is fine in England, you know, thoroughly deserved.
Doesn't Lionel say it's all bollocks? I mean, he just has contempt for the whole lottery thing, ironically.
Well, his brother has won tiny amounts on the, one of his brothers on the lottery, so he thinks it's all rubbish. And that's just to make it even more ridiculous and arbitrary that he should win this huge amount.
Talking again with Martin Amis. Let me open the phone lines, by the way, and we would like to hear from you. We invite you to join this conversation. Lots to talk about, not only with the new novel, but remembering Christopher Hitchens. I want to talk about Saul Bellow, who was a very important figure in both our lives, and we'd like to hear from you, and certainly cordially invite you to join this conversation if you're a reader of Martin Amis or if there's something you'd like to contribute. And I just want to get on record here because I think it's fascinating. Martin Amis' four favorite films, The Godfather, Raging Bull, The Wild Bunch, and Blade Runner, all obviously very passive and nonviolent type of cinema. Feel free to join the program. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. We welcome your phone calls and your participation. Again, you can join us now, toll-free at 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or go to our Facebook page, and you can also tweet us. Our handle is @KQED Forum. I suppose the just talk about Bellow for a moment as we're coming up on the break here, because I think we both loved him and his work, and in many ways he became a kind of, I wanted him to kind of adopt me, but he became a real sort of spiritual literary father for you, didn't he?
He did. Well, I rang him up on the day my father died and said, you know, the baton passes to you now. And he was very affectionate and a very sunny man. When he came to stay in 2001, the summer of 2001, it was Katie at lunch and I'm a gigolo at breakfast. He had a good singing voice and he woke up happy. He was that sort of man.
He did have a truculent side, I'm sure you could attest.
Well, he had a combative side. I don't think truculent is right. I never saw him ever short with anyone.
I did, publicly. Fortunately, not with me, but with others, yeah.
But he was then coming down with Alzheimer's. That was 4 years before he died. And amazingly and revealingly, when September the 11th happened, he couldn't quite take it in. And I know another, an old lady who was very bright and on the ball, but couldn't take it in either. It was as if the event was just too large.
We'll be back. Go to a quick break. Return with Martin Amis. Join us. Toll free, 866-733-6786. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Martin Amis, and his new book is Lionel Aspo, State of England. He's also author of numerous other works, including The Rachel Papers, Money, and London Fields. And he's speaking tomorrow at 7 p.m. at the Jewish Community Center in San Francisco, and that's on California Street, and Thursday at Book Passage in Corte Madera at 7 p.m. with yours truly as his interlocutor, which is a role I'm trying to fulfill here this morning. And we were talking about Bellow before we went to the break, and the sense also, I think, Because it's come up before, I believe, in another interview I did with you, and it came up with Hitchens and with Rushdie and with many British writers particularly who were drawn to his novels. So it's curious to me how they went across the pond and fell in love with Bellow as a writer.
Yeah. There's a funny story about... I wrote a piece, the introduction to The Everyman, Augie March, The Adventures of Augie March, the great American novel published in 1953. And the quest for the great American novel was over. I mean, that's it. Augie March is it. And I reread the novel for perhaps the third or fourth time and then sat down to write about it. And I found my IQ was brutally depressed, that it was about in just about double figures. And I slaved through and did write the introduction, which was nearly all quotations. And then not long after... Salman Rushdie said, I finished rereading Augie March today. He said, and then I had a terrible time. I don't know what went wrong at my desk. He said, I just, sitting there thinking, it's all gone. There's nothing left. I can't do it. There's no hope. And I said, don't worry. It was just that you'd finished Augie March. It's a dumbfounding novel, literally, in that you finish it and think there's nothing more to say about anything.
Especially if you're a novelist.
Absolutely.
You, of course, have gone on the record about mentioning Rushdie makes me think about things you've said about the Islamic fanaticism, and said some things that took courage to say. You talked, as Rushdie had shown, misogynistic and homophobic, but also used the word, I believe, psychotic about the real fanatics, the excess that we're unfortunately still seeing to this day. And blowback on that, did you have, or?
No, not really. I mean, a vilification. Yeah, what I meant, and I think what he meant, is that, it's a Islamism. We've got to get a better word for it. Takfirism, which approves of the, it's a heresy where you're allowed to kill other Muslims because they'll get their heavenly reward. It's Salafism. It's an ideology grafted onto a religion. And the trouble with both those, ideology and religion, is that they have violence locked up in them, because an ideology or religion is meant to explain everything, and, of course, nothing does that. So as soon as it's challenged, it can't be defended with mind alone. So the fists will tighten, and in the ill phrase, you'll begin to think with the blood. So there is this core of violence in it, as there is even in ideology as emollient as PC.
I've always associated thinking with the blood with Lawrence. I think that's his.
Is it? Yes.
Yeah, I believe it is. Right. You're outspoken also about supporting Obama, almost passionately one, and I was struck by that fact in light of Des being half black.
Yeah, well, it's... I've been dangerously saying that, since America is the leader of the world and has been since the Second World War, and according to many thinkers, a force for good, in that there have been no wars between the great powers since then, and they have shaped a kind of a liberal trade system, and democracy has been the model through, gravitational example. And 120 democracies in the world now. That wouldn't be the case if China were the leading nation. So when it comes to an election, I think it would be responsible for Americans to think, what would the world want? Or the free world. And I don't think you'd find a single person in Europe who would vote for Mitt Romney. As Clive James, the great... parodist and essayist said, it's like with Barry Manilow, who's very popular and terrible, and Clive wrote, everyone you know thinks Barry Manilow is terrible, but everyone you don't know thinks he's great. And that's how I feel about the Republicans, that it is increasingly now, impossibly extreme and repellent. And now I'm a a resident in America, I feel it very viscerally that I will be appalled if Romney is president. He's a hick. Mormonism should be brought up, I think, since it's the only issue on which he hasn't wavered. And it's, you know, how can you go to Jerusalem and be the leader of the free world when you think that the Garden of Eden was situated in Missouri?
Do you read Andy Borowitz by any chance? Or do you know that name?
He's
a satirist, which, in fact, I thought your book was rich with Swiftian satire, and then you corrected me in an interview I read where you said, no, I'm an ironist in this book. I'm not a satirist. It's a fascinating distinction. But
yeah.
Andy Borowitz is a satirist, and there's been another gaffe that Romney has made. And so Andy Borowitz's recent, it's in The New Yorker, in the new issue of The New Yorker, he said, the headline is, Romney to have his jaw wired. Of course, you could say the same about Biden. For the next days that are left in the election, it will be wired so that he can't speak, and then he goes into some rather funny material. But let me go into some of our callers, and we begin with you, Bob. You're on. Hi.
Hi. So, I'm a fan of Hitchens, who you talked about earlier, Wordcraft, and certainly I agree with him some, but when I disagreed with him, when I found that he was out of line, he was just as belligerent. And so, you know, I might find that person like that to be a good friend or companion, but I don't know why I should pay attention to him as a pundit or a public figure. Because, you know, he was basically a jerk in public about a lot of things.
Well, he was obstinate, and a lot of people. Maybe you could address this, Martin, because there were a lot of people who were very angry at him over his stance on Iraq, which went back to his failing for the Kurds, I think.
It did, and he was slightly ideological, and he was
a Marxist for years.
He was a
Trotskyite.
And he never stopped being a Trotskyite, or Trotskyist, as he would say. He said, only a Stalinist would call me a Trotskyite. But why was he loved? It was because you can get common sense anywhere. That's an everyday commodity. What Hitchens brought was he made thinking a dramatic experience. And not always right, but always enlivening, always vivifying, and in great prose. So that's why we value him.
Talking with Martin Amis, his new book is Lionel Lapso, State of England, the subtitle, State of England. I mean, we're supposed to associate Lionel, I know that's a kind of subgenre, we're supposed to associate Lionel as being maybe State of England? Or?
Yeah, well, it's my 12-year-old daughter said, enough with the subtitles, Daddy, for crying out loud, she said, with good instinct, because it slightly misdirects the reader, perhaps. There used to be novels called State of England novels, which were earnest novels of ideas, and this is an ironic nod at that, because my novel is not a novel of ideas. It's a dramatized and slightly weird take on England.
We're getting, since you mentioned Romney, a couple of listeners who talk about a column that you wrote that I've not had the pleasure of reading, a recent column dissecting Mitt Romney, and one of my interns, our interns just brought it into me and underlined the following. All we lack was a live feed to Romney's characteristic smile of pain, that of a man with a very sore shoulder who has just eased his way into a tight tuxedo. Perhaps this partly explains why the nominee remains so opaque and unrelaxed. He never came close to settling the question at all. Marika must ask, is Mitt the kind of guy you'd like to have a glass of water with? Yeah, you wouldn't speak of having a beer with Romney, I guess, would you?
I always thought it was a scream that George W. Bush won the election because he was the kind of guy you could have a beer with. And in fact, he's the kind of guy you can't have a beer with because he's a dry drunk. So you've had two Republicans running who you couldn't have a beer with. But Romney, you can't even have a glass of tea with.
Obama certainly has tried to present himself. I mean, when he had the beer summit with Skip Gates and the police chief in Massachusetts, a police, wasn't a chief, actually. He was just
patrolman.
Yeah. That was the Beer Summit, you know, and that was Obama trying to say, I'm like you guys. But this is a guy who bowled 37 before the Pennsylvania primary. Somehow that bowling score of 37 doesn't make you exactly a member of my proletariat class.
No, but apparently he's a mean basketball player.
He is. Vanity Fair, Michael Lewis, has a piece, and he talks about his basketball playing. And mean is the right word. He plays tough and aggressive. And brooks no quarter, apparently, and has tough players playing with him.
We ought to be frank about the appeal of Obama, though. And it's, you know, it's a great... I, of course, love him because he's a good writer. And not since Lincoln has there been a good writer in the White House. But really, all that aside, it's that he does so much to heal the great wound in American life. Slavery... And a question that Americans felt so strongly about that they committed 650,000 fratricides over the question, the Civil War, you know, not so long ago. And he is a great symbol of moving on from that. And I don't believe that that some of the hostility or a lot of the hostility towards him from the other side is to do with race.
Oh, I believe it is. But, you know, we have our own little class war going on here with this presidential election, too. I mean, the great secret for many Americans is it's just as class divided in some ways as England. I mean, the fact of the matter is that there are those who are saying that Obama wants to socialize the country or turn it into some kind of socialist European type of state. And the Romney supporters... feel very strongly and passionately this way. They feel Romney will go along with free market and will, you know, take away socialism, bring back capitalism. It does get very class divided.
During those town hall meetings a couple of years ago, you'd hear people saying, I don't want to live in the Soviet Union, you know, and they really do think he's a socialist. Well, he may want to socialize the country to the extent that LBJ did, perhaps. The Great Society on top of the New Deal. But a centrist, strictly centrist Martian who landed here would be pretty sure that Romney wants to plutocratize the country. Not only this one idea, this one flop of an idea, tax cuts for the rich. It's all this talk about we should respect money as if Americans don't respect it enough. I mean, tax cuts for the rich would never be mentioned, let alone tabled and passed and given a second term in any other country in the West. Americans are superstitious about money. They think if you make $200 million, then that means you can run a country. And all that, whenever his policies are attacked, Romney is putting together this tinker toy vocabulary of politics of envy, you know, class hatred, class warfare, while they seem to be making a power grab, accompanied by the super PAC money. They're trying to buy the election with that, while simultaneously stealing it with voter suppression and gerrymandering. I'm amazed that the passions aren't higher in the Occupy sector. And I went to the ones in Tampa and in Des Moines, as well as in New York, and. It seems to me that there's no heat there, no fire. And surely democracy is not being threatened as gravely as it is being now in living memory. And that lefty heat seems to me been bred out of the American youth. And it's all bottles of mineral water and, a wrapper and a tambourine with no bite to it at all.
You sound despairing a bit of that, huh?
No, because I think Obama will win quite easily, I'll be horrified if he doesn't.
You know, when you talk about Romney as the plutocrat and all that, just perhaps an important footnote here is when he was governor of Massachusetts, of course, he was much more over on the left of the center. I mean, that's where the national health care model came from and all of that.
Yeah.
And he was really, to a great extent, very pragmatic about that. You know, he knew he was in Massachusetts and he knew he had a have those kinds of positions and so forth. And then, you know, the whole fight to get the nomination became one of feeding red meat to the base and the polarized right base now.
Well, what does that tell you about him? I mean, flip-flopper is not strong enough. His only rock-hard conviction is his religion, his slightly laughable religion. And on everything else, he's an air sniffer. But he hasn't stood up at all to the Tea Party wing, and he's now unelectable, I think. I mean, demographically, as one of his advisors said, you know, they're just going for the white voter, and a weary advisor said, no one is ever going to try and do this ever again because the numbers just won't work. He'll have to match Bush Sr.'s success with white voters to win this election, or better it. And only 8% of Americans think that the rich are taxed too much. And who are those 8%? Americans tell me that they're people who are poor now, but when they're rich, as they still hope to be, they don't want to pay any tax either. So he has that noble 8% and a diminishing white base, and it's disappearing. And, you know, your children, what do they think about gay marriage? Nothing. It doesn't weigh with them at all. Abortion will go on being a telling issue because it's a distressing subject. But all the other social issues are evaporating.
When you talk about Romney and money, it brings me back to your novel, because there is, as I deconstruct your novel in my own mind, a disdain for avarice and for belief in money, and it comes across very strongly.
Yeah, well,
it's consistent in your work.
It ought to be stressed that success is good, but greed is bad. And it's ignoble.
That's not what Ivan Bosky told us. And the ignobility of it is certainly something that I think you have been attached to as a writer for all these many years, it's fair to say?
The attitude to money in England is dramatically different. And you see it in fiction, which is my field, that when American novels discuss money, it's without any anxiety. In England, where you'd have to take an attitude that is sort of just redistributive. We're sort of much guiltier about money, and I think that's not a bad thing. Sorbello is perhaps the only writer who's consistently in his work attacked money. And he says, he's talking about the tax on sewers in ancient Rome, and the emperor said, pecunia no-no-let, money doesn't smell, meaning he's going to tax, he's taxing sewers, but the money doesn't smell. And Bello wrote, in America today, money is the only thing that doesn't stink. Everything else stinks. And he said that attitude of, if you're so smart, why aren't you rich, has completely circumambient now in America. And he said, money is a strange stuff, the root of all evil, and strongly associated in metaphor with excrement. And Bella wrote, money has survived its identification as the root of all evil, and marches on from there.
I'm also reminded of Herzog talking about hemorrhaging money and saying, money is not my medium, I am a medium for money. And that's one of the things that makes him, of course, lovable, I think.
Yeah. Yes, and his characters are hopeless about money on the whole. Yeah.
Tommy Wilhelm. Seize the day, yeah. Talking again with Martin Amis, and just a reminder that he will be speaking tomorrow at the Jewish Community Center in San Francisco at 7 o'clock, and Thursday, 7 o'clock at Book Passage. He is, you can be around. You like San Francisco, don't you?
It's a beautiful city. The summer weather is unpredictable, but it looked at its very best yesterday under a blue sky. There's nothing quite like it.
You have to get across the Golden Gate and up into Napa if you like real warm weather. I mean,
that's right. It's just a
big
pocket,
change. Just across the Golden Gate, seriously, and to Marin and Napa and up north.
Mark Twain said summer in Los Angeles, I mean in San Francisco, was the worst winter he'd ever lived through.
I don't know if that was Mark Twain. That remains moot.
No.
Yeah, it's one of those things that, I mean, lots of splendid things that have been attributed to Twain, probably to you too, now that you're an iconic figure. Next thing I'm going to ask you is about that kind of literary icon status that you have. Are you comfortable in those clothes, in that role?
Well, it's... I sometimes think that that if you could get the attention of enough readers to support you, which is the aim, then if you could do it without any fame accruing to you, then that would be nice. But you can't, so it just has to be part of the job. But when there is so much out there clamoring for everyone's attention, and when we're told attention spans are diminishing, and now more than ever in a globalized, interconnected world, perhaps fiction hasn't got, literary fiction has got a strange future ahead of it. It's already changed. As the pace of history seems to have speeded up in the last couple of generations, the novel has got much more streamlined. I mean, I reread Humboldt's Gift, Bellow's magnum opus, the other day, and I thought, this is magnificent stuff, but if it had been published now, it wouldn't spend 8 months on the bestseller list. It would have a readership of about 3,000 or 4,000. There are not enough readers for the essayistic, divagationary novel, meditative novel. The novels have had to streamline themselves, become more aerodynamic. The arrow of propulsion is much sharper. And it's not, I think it myself, it's not that it's a bandwagon. It's just that, novelists are modern people too, and they feel this acceleration of history.
You're listening to Forum. We're talking with Martin Amis. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. So the novel is not dead.
Well, look at the fate of poetry, and I think that's on the same parabola, because what a poem does, certainly what a lyric poem does, is stop the clock, saying we're going to explore this 20-line epiphany, and we're going to we're stopping the clock while we do this, and that's so counter to how everyone is feeling these days. When you're reading a huge piece in the New York Review of Books about Iraq, and you see a poem at the foot of the page, you think, well, what's that doing there? I haven't got time to read you. I'm busy with this. And everyone's too busy for poetry. And they talk about dumbing down. There's also been a parallel process, numbing down. When you read a poem, you have to examine your own feelings. You mingle with the poet and weigh your responses with his or hers. And people don't want to do that anymore. That's why they're on their phones all the time. They don't want, they're made uncomfortable by solitary thought.
Or even contemplative thought, which is really a part of solitary thought, or ought to be. But it's the publishing industry, too. I mean, the Internet has changed everything, and it's a cliche to say, but it has created a different world. But there's also the publishing industry and e-books now, and the proliferation of a whole different kind of way of reading.
Yeah, what they say, I've...
Email.
I've been asking publishers about the future of publishing, and they say certain foreseeable things like the chains are going to disappear. There's going to be e-stuff on the one hand and independence on the other, where real book lovers will pay full price for the books they want, and I can imagine a future where literary novel goes back to what it was when I started out, before the big expansion of the media around 1980, a minority interest sphere where there's just a review of your book, but no profiles, no interviews, no book tours, no signings, no parties, no photos, just shorn to the minimum. And that holds no terrors for me, because I know what it's like.
Well, you're also, if I may put it in this context, a dedicated writer. I mean, someone who gets up, looks forward to writing, does the yeoman work that has to be done, put your shoulder to the wheel, all that, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, when you're Desmond's age at the beginning of that novel, it's 15, 14, self-consciousness dawns and you start having a communion with yourself and with your mind, and you write poems and keep notebooks and diaries.
And write to columnists who answer questions too. I mean, that's part of
if you're in trouble.
Yeah, that's part of his growth as a writer, or as a young man, excuse me. Yeah.
But I think that the novelists are those that never grew out of that, and that's what they like, is communing with themselves. You have to have a huge appetite for solitude. And you're, even more sort of worryingly, you're most alive when you're alone.
That's why I never made it to your, not only your level of novel writing, but just to a kind of level of novel. I was also, like you, kind of dissuaded when I read Augie March. I can't ever produce anything even resembling this or coming close to this.
It's his extraordinary, and I think unique, that such an inspiring novel is so dispiriting for the creative energies, because it preempts them.
You know, the original title of that novel was Life Among the Machiavellians?
Was it? Because he's always getting instructions.
That's right. From the reality instructors,
reality
as he calls them.
Yeah.
Martin Davis, so good to have you back with us on Forum. Thank you.
Pleasure.
And good luck with this new novel and all your upcoming writing. Again, Martin Amis's new book is Lionel Apso, and State of England is the subtitle, despite his daughter's dismay. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And remind you can actually meet Martin Amis tomorrow at the JCC in San Francisco and Thursday at Book Passage with me at 7 p.m. in Corte Madera. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell, Amy Machado, Amanda Stupai, and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.